takes his awakened hold and leads the fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, so does this seed us so. From the water from below, till the rain comes tumbling down.
Okay, I just want to take you through a little piece of heaven here. Our farm's located 2.5 miles, 3 miles out of Leavenworth. Elevation on it's about 1,200 to 1,500 feet. And it's probably one of the most diversified organic farms in the state. And it's run primarily by family farm setup. In other words, I don't want to get too involved where the family can't farm it. I rely on the wife, I rely on the kids, I rely on the kids as friends. And it's a cooperative effort, and it was said by many that it wouldn't work, but I've proved that it can work. And so you might say that with the help of the Lord, this is the positive side of what we've heard in the last two lectures by Dan. It's actually working, and if you have any questions about why it's working or how I make it work or anything like that as I go through these, just feel free to talk up. I might say to start out with, before my philosophy, the way it differs from other growers, is it to me first the soil comes first. To me second the plant comes next. Third the income or the profit. On a conventional farm it's exactly the other way around. Profit comes first, the plant comes second, and the soil takes rear seat. Now, by having that philosophy of the soil being number one to me, that is where my energy goes. That is, if I have any money left to spend, I put it into my soil program. So I'm constantly doing soil audits on an 8 to 5 year program. I do an extensive soil audit. It tells me everything from how much iron's in the soil to how much boron's in it, where my nitrogen's at, where my organic matter's at, calcium, all this. And we bought the property in 75, so pretty soon I've been farming this piece of ground organically for 20 years. And since then, it's come a long ways. It's just, the buildup of the soil has just reaped some unreal harvest, and it's like I've created a monster that I gotta deal with. It's a good thing the kids are getting older as I go, I know that.
Can you describe that soil program a little bit more for us? What are you using to build up the soil?
Okay, I got a real unique system of on-farm cycle that's, I don't bring in nitrogen fertilizers in bags and sacks. I got cows. And I compost my manure. I pile it with the tractor and I age it. And when the cows are in the barn in the winter, I'm mixing in wood shavings, planer shavings from the sawmills, and grass hay is for bedding, and they trample that into the manure, and it's all mixed in with the wood chips for bedding. And then I pile it out in open air and age it. And then I got a manure rotation program that every second year, some part of the farm is getting a cycle of that manure program. So in other words, I won't fertilize the garden with manure every year. It's every second year. That way the soil has time to deal with manure, and the other crops get a shot of manure, and nothing's brought on. The only thing I bring in is the minerals I need to balance it. Certain plants feed heavier than others, and they need more minerals. And so, like, every year I'm putting down some kind of mineral. This year I put down sulfur. So I'll probably, this spring I'll do another soil audit and decide from that what to go with. Maybe I'll be putting on copper. And along with along with the soil program, feeding the soil and bringing the soil to its absolute healthiest state that I can bring it to, I also do foliar spraying on the plants, the gardens, and that's a whole other subject there. That's foliar feeding is really come a long way with the organic movement, and it's to the point now where you can get chelated minerals that are readily available to the plants just as soon as you spray them on. The uptake, if there's a shortage in the soil, it can be helped along, maybe not cured, but helped along for that growing season until the minerals you have added to the soil have started working for you.
Can you point out the boundaries?
Okay, we got 39 acres. Goes up along this timber line. This is a bench up there. She's way up this hill. And then comes back down like this. Meets back up over here. It's very, very diversified.
And the buildings are the areas of what's what?
Yeah, this is a good shot. This pear orchard. This
pasture?
This pasture. Okay. Starting here is hay field.
Upper garden.
There's another orchard up here. Apples.
All behind the house.
Cherries are sitting behind the house and in front of the house. Mm-hmm. There's a big garden right on the side of the barn that you can't see. And then there's another market garden up on this bench. And then past the market garden is a Christmas tree patch.
Is this looking south or looking north?
This is looking north because our home is home-built solar home, made all out of materials off our property. And there's three layers of south glaze.
So the house is
one, two,
south.
Three, yeah.
The previous facing more west.
Is that focused?
Is it west out of that?
Yeah. The screen is moving.
Yeah, there you go.
These are cherries right across here. They're coming up. I've since planted more cherries behind the house. Mm-hmm. This Macintosh apples.
What kind of cherries are you growing?
Bings, Rainiers, and Republicans. Okay. Black Republicans.
Will the county agent tell you what type of soil you have and what you need, or do you have to do it right?
I'm very anti-government. I want them boys off my property. I'm sorry I'm soured like that, but I choose to go to private soil audits. The latest one I had done was by Albion Labs, and the soil went back to Maine. Came back, and then Integrated Fertility Management analyzed it for me and broke down the information into something practical that a farmer can take use of, like how much of it to add, how many pounds, how many tons or whatever of the different. This is another view. The picture we saw first was taken up here looking this way, and this is taken looking the other way. So you're seeing the apple orchard here.
And which way? West?
This is the east. For her when she was small enough I could carry her home in my arms. And she's our milk cow now. This is Beulah letting out a breech birth calf. But it all worked out. Cow. Everybody comes to examine the newborn. So we commonly have 2 to 3 calves born every spring. There's usually 1, maybe 2 to butcher every year.
Yeah.
Who's that over there?
There's a neighbor who really fans of the milk. They come clamoring after it.
So one of the cats aren't there.
This year, so all these people are really, don't know what to do. Keep it in our refrigerator, gallon jars, glass, returnables.
So you sell it to the neighbors?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we bring it to the farmer's market.
No, unpasteurized.
Mm-hmm.
You're able to do that here in Washington Market?
We had one director of the market that didn't want me to do it, and so I quit doing it just while she was the director of the market. But the prior director wanted me to, and I liked it, you know. We kept it in a little cooler and took good care of it. This is one of my favorite pictures here. That's Ivan. And then we move the cows. When spring's done, I bring them to a wetland that I lease for pasture in the summer, and I hay the wetland and run the cows out there. This is a pasture where they go for the summer.
It's right by Leavenworth.
That's right, yeah.
It's in town almost.
And they're in nice, like, hog heaven there. They got tall grass.
Is this purple moose right here in the foreground?
Lupin?
Lupin isn't good for horses. Doesn't bother. I've heard. Doesn't bother cattle at all. They just don't eat it.
I think they ignore it.
Good.
You can go out there right now, and the pasture's eaten down to that high.
Mm-hmm.
There's all these lupin plants around.
Mm-hmm.
And then I do weed management by coming through before they seed and mowing it with the orchard mower, rotary mower behind the tractor. And then that way, when I hay the field in the spring. Or I get 2 cuttings over there. I don't have the weed content in my hay or the seed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a mouse control. Everything has its place on the farm. Those store-bought groceries in there, is there?
There's cream? Oh, yeah, there are.
This is a solar fencer. Pretty neat unit.
Wow.
Electric fencer. This is my one and only farm tractor. Mandatory I have that front loader. I couldn't get along without it. I clean the stalls, pile the manure. All kinds. It's just the handiest thing. This is a 35 horse gasoline. So it's old. It's probably 58-60 vintage.
Did you make the loader?
No, it's a Massey Ferguson loader.
I know when I was in high school, a lot of in the shop they made a lot of loaders.
Loaders.
Little Ford tractors.
That's a real strong built one there. It can take a lot of abuse. I'm piling the manure there to compost. You can see the state it's in. By the time it's broke down through the summer, the smell's gone out of it pretty much. It's got, from being hot, it's white. There's layers through it where there's been a lot of heat and it's white.
Good to jump in.
What? Good to jump in. Are you aerating it a couple times in during the summer?
I just pile it once.
Agitate it? Okay.
I don't agitate it, no. I should, but I like the way it looks when I finally put it out. When I get back home, this is exactly what I'm going to be doing, is loading. This is a 1925 McCormick horse-drawn manure spreader that I converted to tractor pull and got it for $10 over in Monroe. It's the oldest piece of machinery on the farm and it works like a champ.
That was Halloween. Except for the waffle.
Here.
The waffle iron.
This is sulfur.
I like the commentary from the doctor.
This is sulfur, and I shake. I'm trying to balance my pH, bring it down, because I got acid soil because I'm around a forest. Sulfur is one of the key elements to balancing pH. It's on the acid side. And so about every second, third year, I'm giving it a shot of sulfur, and then I monitor my pH and see how I've done. So eventually I'll probably be able to knock back to once every 5 years just to maintain it. But I'm at 7.7, and I'd like to get it down to 7. There, I'm putting the sulfur in the bed.
Is that compost made in a year?
Yeah, less than that. Well, yeah, the whole cycle's a year. It's in the corral or in the barnyard there before I pile it for half a year, and then it's in the pile a half a year before it goes on the crops.
Would there be any other way to make your pH lower without using sulfur? Or is it, I mean, is there any way from the farm you could create
sulfur? On farm?
Well, manure from, let's say, chickens or pigs, would they be higher in content than? I mean, I know that ammonias are different, like in chickens, kind of.
You're trying to bring the pH down.
Yeah.
Pine needles would be one way, but they're acidic.
Okay. I just was curious.
Lime would work good.
Yeah.
But I don't have a line quarry of mine.
Darn, huh?
The other thing is with lime, all my orchards are in cover crops.
Library, right there. Books.
And so the sulfur helps the alfalfas and the clovers that I got for the cover crops fix nitrogen into the soil. They're nitrogen fixing plants. And with the lime, I don't believe myself that it would do me as much good as it would if I used sulfur. As far as my cover crop benefit.
You take a crop of alfalfa off of your orchard. Do you actually harvest it, or is it just like...
When the trees were young, I planted my orchard at a wide enough space and I could swath it with a swather. Well, that went good till the trees were about 5 years old, and then I was mowing along and I mowed one off, and it was about this big around. I turned around to shake my head and go, darn, I hit a tree, and then I hit another one. And I tried it one more time after that, and I knocked more apples on the ground than it was beneficial to mow it. Mm-hmm. So then at that stage, I got an orchard mower and started just mulching it under.
So green manure. Mm-hmm.
Green manure mulch, yeah, and it's really helped build the organic matter up.
So this manure here, you're incorporating that then? In this green manure, you're actually tilling the soil in between here.
Yeah, I have a no-till program as far as plowing and disking on the orchards.
Okay.
But the tilth of the soil is being built up by my soil program, which is a no-till program, no machinery program, but it's getting the manures and the and the boron and the zinc and everything else I add to it. This is a pear block, Bartlett pears. You can see the spread cover I get, that it's not coming out in big chunks and hunks like it would if it was green. When it's composted, it comes out nice and uniform like that.
Right.
The faster I pull the wagon, the farther it spreads under the trees. That's the apple orchard. And this is the winter job, pruning. Henry here has been helping me 2 years now prune in the winter. And it takes the two of us about 10, 12 weekends to knock it out. I got the trees trained a central leader system. In other words, there's one main stem, and then there's the leaders coming off the stem.
Are they standard size trees?
They're 3/4 dwarf. If I had planted dwarf trees, I'd have lost more orchard to the snow and the ice slide or the snow shift.
Do you prune differently because you're doing organic? I mean, I know that.
Yes. It's a very good question. It's very important. There's a lot of handwork goes into farming fruit organic, and that is one of your biggest time savers is your pruning. It eliminates, if you do your detailed pruning on your buds, it eliminates half the time that you have to spend out there in the summer thinning the fruit to get it to size. That tree died. That was a Gravenstein and had a hard winter. I nursed it along, and it just gets to the point where, you know, I might as well put a new tree in the ground. It's just, it's not going to ever amount to anything after it's had that much winter damage. You can see how close my orchard is incorporated to the timber there. It's real close. Here I'm training the trees. I saw these on the table saw, and they're spreaders. They got a notch in each end. And by having that central leader up, you can spread the lateral leaders down and get production earlier. It's hard to grow apples on a leader that's coming up like the angle of this one. If you get your leaders coming out flatter, you're going to set more fruits, and your fruit's going to color better. There's a lot of advantages to it.
Why would it
build stronger crotches? These crotches hold the weight when the fruit's on.
Why would it set fruit better? I can understand. understand the color and the, you know,
The bud positioning. Bud positioning on the leaders, they get more light. They're stronger.
Mm-hmm. We need to watch time today. It's been 45 minutes.
Oh, man.
No, I'd say keep going. Take, this is great.
This is all educational.
Yeah.
Don. This is Tree Doctor. It's a latex-based plastic sealer that seals wounds. This here is another integrated thing I do to keep the ants from farming the aphids. This is stuff called Tanglefoot. Mm-hmm. I spread it on with a spatula and it's a real sticky, gooey stuff and it keeps the ants from running up and down the tree and farming the aphids.
In the spring?
I go through periodically, I buy it by the gallon and go through periodically through the year and isolate trees that are problem trees and paint those only. My biggest problem is the trees closest to the pine hillside because that's where the ants winter. Mm-hmm. And then they bring them down to those first two rows of trees there, three rows. This is my oldest boy who's not here, Woody. And they're picking up the pruning brush. I don't worry about all the little stuff laying on the ground because the orchard mower flails it up and spits it out as organic material for the soil. But I got to get the bigger pieces out because when I come through with my dormant oil spray, it's tangling in my spray hose. I don't speed spray, I hand spray. Here we are on the dormant oil spray. I might say here at this point, when I first started out doing this, my only information I was getting was through Rodale. You're talking in the early 70s now.
Yeah.
That was my only insight. I was in an atmosphere around me where everything was negative towards me. You can't do it. You'll never make it. You're going to go broke. Everything was negative towards me. And I said, oh yeah, you watch me. And I went about to prove it. And to find the materials I needed back in that day and age was very, very difficult. They were virtually non-existent. I mean, I had to find fish oil, which this is, I had to do all the research of where it was coming from and how to get it, and it wasn't really, I don't know how old were you, suitable, but it was there, you know, it was a byproduct of the seafood business, and a friend of mine started buying drums of it and selling it out under the table to different organic growers that were starting up. I bought a drum of it, and it lasted me 5 years. By the time I had bought my next drum, it was readily available. I mean it.
Yeah. When did the folks in Wenatchee at Integrated Fertility Management go into business?
He started about 79. See, he was my college professor in forestry.
Okay.
Phil Undershoots. And then the budget got cut at college and he had to make a living another way and he went into Integrated Fertility Management with a couple other friends and they backed out and he ended up running the whole thing himself, and he's the main supplier of all Eastern Washington, if not the country.
I think a lot of the orchard folks in the Midwest go through here. Yeah,
wow.
He's
like
great.
All the Wisconsin organic growers come through.
He is a big help.
Yeah,
big help.
A lot of information.
A lot of conferences he does talks or organizes the conferences. Great guy. Kids drives a tractor, and I walk behind and spray the trees. Or I sit on the tractor seat and do it.
What, I'm not familiar with orchards. What is dormant oil for? What does it do?
Okay. I'll make an apple grower out of you. Dormant oil is my most important spray. And what it does is it smothers or coats the eggs of the carryover larva,
okay. The
insects that are your pests. And if you get good cover on your dormant sprays, you've eliminated 20% or 30% of the rest of the sprays you need to do the rest of the year. So to me, that's the two dormant sprays I put on are the most important thing I do in that orchard. I do a dormant spray and then I do a delayed dormant spray. Sometimes the delayed dormant spray has other biological insecticides in it. But my first spray, my dormant spray, which I was filling in the tank, I spray on the trees when all they are is just sticks of woods there. This is a foliar spray I'm putting on here. I'm spraying chelated zinc and chelated manganese. Kids are driving tractors when they're 8 years old or younger. There's a dormant spray. That's what the orchard looks like when I'm putting on the fish oil. And it smells like the ocean when I'm done. It's great. Some people hate it, but I love it.
You don't get to travel much, but...
Hold on, bug killer. How many trees are there?
I got 400 fruit trees, approximately.
400?
Yeah. These are ladybugs. And this is part of my insect relief program. I usually get 2 shipments a year, one in the spring and one in the summer, on several varieties of insects. And they come out in sectaries in California. And depending on my problem and the situation in the year, I might not order one kind, but I might double my order on another kind. So you have to be an entomologist and you have to be in tune with your insect populations. I got these little Dixie cups thumbtacked on the trees, and I drop different insects in those, and then they crawl around and find their feed. This is a good picture, shows a cover crop in the orchard. A lot of the orchards around that are non-organic, you see them out there mowing them down to golf course style all the time. I'm not into that. I think it's beneficial to leave it get long and tall and have more material there when you do mow it. My final decision to mow is when my rainbird sprinklers quit turning because the grass is so tall that it's up in the rainbird. There they're going to work. Okay, now here is a cedar log Don shot one early spring day, and this is where the ladybugs wintered over that year. There's a little rot, heart rot in this cedar log, and they went in there and huddled up like bees to keep themselves warm. And they're emerging out, the natural carryover. There's my orchard mower. It offsets from the tire so I can get in close to the trees.
Speaking of bees, do you keep them?
Yeah, you gotta have bees. It's pretty important. They pollinate everything around there. I usually have 2 to 3 hives. You gotta go real slow or it just about drags you off the track when you go by those things.
Okay.
Not every year. See, this was a peach year for us. We had really good peach yields this year. Sold them and canned them and ate them. And but the year before that, didn't have a one. And the year before that, a hard winter freeze, 20 below zero, took out the peaches. So
this particular.
Oh yeah. You deal with that organically too. I use a copper sulfate spray for peach leaf curl, Corinthian blight. These are Albertas. This tree since has died, all but 1 liter of it from winter kill.
Do you have people come in and help you pick then?
I try not to. I got such a small operation. I got so many varieties that they're not all coming on at once, so it's not a big pressure load on me. The kids come home from school, they pick fruit. You know, I get a bin of fruit picked like that, and then there's a day's work packing it out, sorting through it and getting it all packed to the different sorts.
Yeah.
It commonly, I'll have five different sorts come out of a bin of fruit. And the kids and Don and we all participate in that too. I'm trying to keep my trees down so I don't need a big ladder. Hopefully I'll never need a ladder taller than that. It's so much easier if you don't have to climb up that high to get your stuff. Now these are Macintosh apples.
Bucket.
Set of forks on the back of the tractor. 25 box bin.
Macintosh, the pineapple we talked about. Yeah.
What kind of apple is that?
What is it?
It's
what
a coffee that? Cup.
That's old.
This is a packing process here.
And you pack in the barn, or do you have a packing shed? Or?
No, we pack out in the open air or in the barn. This particular shot's in the barn. These are the trays. Certain people that buy my fruit, if they're going to ship it, if I sell to a wholesaler, which I try not to do, they want them in trays because they might ship the fruit all up and down the West Coast or who knows where it goes. It might go to Utah or Wyoming. The fruit rides better if it on the trucking if it's in these cardboard trays. Well, that's fine, all fine and dandy, but it's quite expensive and time-consuming deal to me to do it that way. So
what would you have into boxes, box and trays?
Commonly, the top and bottom box and the trays, I might have $1.50 into the box plus the jiffy pads. On Goldens, often I'll wrap them in crepe paper. Same on the pears. Helps them protect from bruising. Goldens have a real thin skin and they bruise real easy. Real easy. Now that's what the Lord can do to you. If you let it get to you, it can really, it can put you into buying things like insurance. I don't have any insurance. I don't even have homeowner's insurance on accident. So if I hired somebody to come pick my fruit and they fell off the ladder, I could lose the ranch. But it's my choice to take that gamble and leave me vulnerable and let the Lord deal with that for me. As long as I'm living right and doing right by God, I feel like this kind of thing is watched over for me. It's kind of like what goes around comes around.
How often do you get hail?
This particular storm was a real devastation to us, and it was maybe a 1 out of 10 year storm.
Okay.
Often we get a small hail storm that, well, maybe cull out a percentage of your crop.
Yeah.
But this one here wiped us out.
Did you juice that year then? Or?
If I had a bank loan for a crop to grow the crop that year, I would have really went in the hole. But I didn't. I don't farm that way.
What do we do with those apples?
They all went juice, yeah. They went to Woodring Orchards for cider. These are the pears that got
there's
bailed.
There's calf.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, these pears got hail because I can see the hail mark on that one there.
Mm-hmm.
But I sorted through them and managed to make something off it. That's a jiffy pad. We buy our boxes flat. We ink stamp them with our logo, the Washington State certification seal, and the address of the farm. This is our mechanic shop.
We've seen that machine.
There's no yellow jackets. What's wrong?
The ducks don't. No.
Part of our family.
They're out scratching in the dirt, having a good time.
Something I might mention here that small gardeners that have flocks of chicken might try if they're into organics is I take and brew a tea out of the waste of the chicken. And we clean out the floor of the chicken coop. Mm-hmm. There's the manure and the hay in there. And I suspend it in a gunny sack in a big barrel and pour water around it. And that's, I go around and actually bucket water out of that, the tea brew out of that, and dump it on plants that are needing nutrients. It works great. It's an instant nutrient. Gotta be a mechanic. This is a part of the logging business, this machine here. We're retracking it. But if I wasn't a mechanic and a welder, oh, I'd have unreal expenses and maintenance of everything. It's just, nothing I have is new. Everything's old and breaks down, and it's just a continual battle to keep everything going.
You know, that's one of the biggest things about, you know, diversity of farming, but diversity of the farmer themselves. You know, things that I grew up that people around where I live knew how to do. You break something, you take it down to Joe because he's got the welder and whatever, and this man could do that, or your dad could do most of it. But it just doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
All the places.
It's just, that's really a lost thing in the family farm.
Yeah.
Like, my tools were handed down to me from my dad. And I got tools that he got from his dad. And they're still working. And I use them every day. This here is a real important piece of machinery for the market garden. This is a rotavator, hard rotavator. Does a 4.5 foot swath. If you start on this side and you end on this side, you don't even leave a tire track in the garden. At the end of the growing season, I come through with that orchard mower that was in the orchard, and it pretty much flails up all the corn stalks and the bean plants and the cucumber vines and just lays them all out in a real nice mulched up material, and this thing turns it up. I very seldom deep plow the garden. Once every 3 years, 4 years, I'll deep plow with a chisel plow, but usually all I'll do is I'll go through with this rotavator in the spring, and then I'll come in with the row maker. The tool bar with a couple of shovels on it, sitting right over here. It makes the raised beds. Don is preparing the spring seedlings for the greenhouse here, building the soil medium. Yeah, we try and either grow our own seeds or get all our seeds from Johnny's. Because they support organic agriculture. Oh, yeah. It's a small business.
Yeah.
They're acclimated to our climate. There's just so many advantages. They sell in bulk. I seed with a tractor seeder quite often, so a packet of seeds is just nothing. You know, don't even put a dent in the bottom of the hopper. You gotta buy it by the pounds, you know, and you gotta find somebody that's growing organic seed because the Washington State Certification Program now requires it. Often in the greenhouse, this is incorporated with part of our house. We got a plant room in there. And we'll start our leeks, our Walla Walla sweets, maybe two or three kinds of hot peppers, some herbs, flowers, a few tomato plants for ourselves. The soil medium she mixes up is one-third garden soil, one-third vermiculite, one-third peat moss. So this takes you back time. That boy there is now 17. Rusty's got some 15. Anyway, here we're bedding in strawberries. You can see the raised beds. I went through with the rotavator, pulled the tool bar through, made the raised beds. This kid here is pushing the plants down the row, and then these kids are keeping the buckets filled, and Casey and myself are opening the slots where the kids are dropping the plants in. And we keep our beds 3 years and then turn them under. So the patch is continually rotating down the garden. 3 years is the maximum for it. We're not big into berries, but it's part of our variety we like bringing to the market. This looks like peas coming out of the ground in spring. This is diatomaceous earth. I use it for insect control on the maggots. It works pretty good. This is another big part of our operation. It's Troy Belt Tiller. But still, you got to hoe the middle of the beds. This is our irrigation in this garden. We've got aluminum two-inch aluminum hand lines. We try and deep water on a 12-hour schedule, twice a week, depending on the temperature.
Are you using well water?
Yeah, we have two irrigation wells. One of them's under that cover there. It's an 8-inch, 40-foot deep. Poor Teller there is about as old as I am. It keeps going. I keep mechanicking it to life.
Wow.
Oh, that's nice.
Wow. It's the upper garden.
Okay, let's see what's going on here. These are strawberries. They have now rotated up to here, and they're coming on down. Okay, now where the strawberries are, I've been growing corn. These, I think, are onions or garlic. Probably onions. This looks like corn coming up here. Now, this particular garden is the bigger of the two. We haven't seen very many shots of it other than the one of us planting strawberries, but it's in a laser trickle tube, flat tube, half-inch tubing, and it gets watered 12 hours stretch two or three times a week. These are wine sap apples here with the spreaders in them. So what I'll do, you can. The next thing to happen here is I'll drive through again with the tractor, with the toolbar, and it'll weed. When I do that, it'll weed this much of it. When the plants are getting up so high that the bottom of the tractor is touching them and knocking them down, then it's time to bring the Troy Belt in. And then in the meantime, this trickle tube gets pulled off on the side and the center gets hand weeded with a hoe. once the plants are up good enough to fend for themselves, it doesn't get weeded anymore. Now, this is seed and green manure. It's a very integral part, and I've been doing it for 10, 15 years. I've tried everything from buckwheat to rye, and I like using rye now. I pretty much stay with rye. But as soon as a crop is done, I disc it so it's cloddy. And that's the state it goes through the winter in. I don't want it a fine soil that's going to compact through the winter. I want it aerated a little bit by the disc, and then the green manure sowed on there. And if the green manure is up good, maybe I'll disc it one more time before fall. If not, I'll disc it in the spring. So if you could go to our house right now and look at our garden, it's like half of it that was the lettuce and the spinach and all the peas and the early crops is all in rye this tall. And then there's a strip that I just worked, and it's got the new plantation of garlic in it. And then the next strip over in the rotation is bare soil that is getting leaves, compost, manure. That's just my cyclone cedar. This is something else I do. These raised beds here are garlic. Garlic gets planted in the fall. Then I come along and top dress it with manure, and that protects it from winter freeze, plus the moisture in the winter, snow melt and rains, leaches nutrients out of the compost and manure down in the garlic, and garlic's a very heavy feeder. And if you can grow premium garlic, you're way ahead of the game if you can grow number two or number three garlic. Premium garlic.
That's what helps with my particular faith journey, is like I have those kinds of pieces. Well,
that's the rapture.
That's the rapture. That's
right. Looks like a garbage truck, but really,
there's a friend of mine who is a spiritual director, who wrote her doctoral paper on the Paschal Mystery as a model for spiritual direction. And her view, and she's very, very Irish Catholic, is that the process of salvation is an ongoing process, and it's a process of being of death and rebirth, you know, that's continuous in our lives, and that's what she says we're called to do. And that's what I think this kind of learning for, in a way, is about. It's a constant death and rebirth to our own ego, to our own agendas, to our own narrow way of being. And Thomas Merton, the wonderful contemplative writer, talked about the false self and the true self. The false self is the self that we've kind of created ourselves, both, ourselves meaning we as individuals, but also our family and our culture, and you know, and all of that. And the true self is the self that God, you know, that God created, and God knows the potential for, and God will aid us along the way if we predispose ourselves. And that's what we're saying that by evolving in praxis is about. It's not earning your way to salvation, but it's predisposing yourself. It's opening yourself up so God can have God's movement in our lives. And it is a very interesting and ongoing and deepening process.
The worst thing anybody can say to me is, in my community, about something about my people. I work with the chronic and mentally ill. They're not my people. Our people.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm employed, but I'm called.
Yeah. 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 No, that's right. That's right. Yeah, the folks that... the folks that I'm with have been so isolated from the rest of our culture. they're folks that we all need to be connected with. And they're folks who have such great gifts for us. And
I don't know how you can do this, maybe. Or you must have some special gift.
No, it's not. Again, let me say, I am gifted. I mean, I'm deeply gifted by these people. And that's how I can do it. And people ask me, why don't you burn out? I mean, we don't lead an easy life. I mean, but what I know is I'm nurtured. I mean, my life is nurtured by the time on the streets, and I have to raise my salary from $0 each year. Okay, that is not nurturing for me to do that, to do the fundraising. But I'm the time I spend with the folks in the streets, that's how I'm nurtured to be able to go out, you know, and kind of hang out to raise money to continue to do it. It's not something that's wonderful about this person. It's something that's wonderful about being in this process. That's what this embeddedness is about. I gave this quote from Gandhi once before, where someone said, you know, kind of a critical, kind of a newspaper person saying, well, why is it you hang out with these? Why do you live amongst the poor? Why do you do this? Aren't you getting something out of it? And he says, yes, these people serve me. I'm not here, so these people serve me. But it's a deeper understanding that we're not different. In other words, I mean, we are different, but we're not different. I mean, I don't want to discount the struggles people have. But the point, the thing is that we're all, you know, we're all in this together. And where I stop and where that person begins is not a very... Not a firm boundary for me anymore. These people that I, you know, the folks I'm with, I mean, we share each other's lives enough now so that what happens to that person happens to me. That's what Gandhi was talking about, and that's what I think we're offered to be able to do and be, and that's what compassion means. Compassion isn't sloppy, you know, isn't that nice? I mean, compassion is a very painful, but a very transforming kind of way of being with one another. So I hope I've talk to that. Okay, is that? Am I using the right kind of words? Or is it? Am I capturing? My cut. It's really. It's a very wonderful process.
Do you think that you've gifted this to these people? Your compassion and your caring has been transferred into them, to them, so that they, in turn, might be a little bit more compassionate to others, to themselves,
oh, sure.
And that their relationships have changed.
You bet.
If so, then that is the grace of God coming in,
oh, yeah.
Working through you, working through
them. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. You bet. Yes. Yes.
I see that much like the coming of physics, for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Well, it's more mystery than that.
There,
a lot more mystery than that.
There is, but there is that action and reaction that goes on, and how that is transmitted to the next person. And if you get into a perfect relationship, that perfect relationship can only be made by God, and then it's transmitted to the person.
But my question is, does every relationship have to be perfect?
No, they,
no,
in fact, they aren't.
So.
Very,
most times,
they're
not.
Are. But so sometimes that love is transmitted 10% or 1%,
yeah.
But there's a change there.
A lot of risk,
risk to get that 1% or 1/10% of that person, but maybe next time it goes up a little bit as a learned behavior change.
Well, I told this story the other night, and I don't think many of you were there, about the kind of giftedness that takes place. And there's a guy who sometimes worships with us, who's chronically mentally ill, lives in the streets. And one day he came up to me, he said, Father George, he said, I want to tell you something. He said, if you want to make money selling aluminum cans, you shouldn't go over to the recycling center here. You should go over the one that's like 4 blocks out, because they give you another 2 cents a pound. Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, this was kind of an off the wall comment. I was walking down the street, this guy's talking about selling. But that was the only gift that he had to offer me. Mm-hmm. And somewhere along the way, he felt gifted from me, from our congregation, and he wanted to reciprocate. And it was a wonderful. It was a blessed gift, and there is reverberation throughout creation, I think, as we engage in these kind of relationships. And there's similarly I think is a reverberation throughout creation of the negative. When we, you know, when so I mean we've, you know, I have a great, I'm a Calvinist in lots of ways. So I really, you know, I really see how fallen we are, and how difficult. Again, I mean, as a psychologist, I see how that fallenness works in such detail, because it's so hard to break out of these patterns, and we're always creating new ones. So you have to always be about creating and uncreating. Well, time is up. Thanks for being here, and it's been good to be with you.